Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The World Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your life, in your world, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm great. Doing great. We got a big show tonight, don't we? It turned into a big show.
I loaded in way more material than we would possibly be able to talk about, and then trumped me. You like doubled that amount with additional topics. So,
if we would just
extend the show for what, 3 hours? I think we could do a 3-hour show tonight. Easy.
Yeah, we got the material, no doubt.
Yeah.
But alas,
and we got the team. We got the team to do a 3-hour show. But, you know, what we don't have is the sponsors. That's what we're really lacking.
Periodically to give us just a second to grab a sip of coffee while the sponsors give their spiel. We should do that. We should think about that.
Wouldn't that sound good too? Live to see it, friends. You're listening to The World Transformed, brought to you by Alcor. I'm just saying, Alcor, if you're listening, just think how good that would sound. Okay. Brought to you by Singularity University. Just a thought. Just throwing it out there. Okay.
Alcor, because not dying is stone cold awesome or something. I don't know.
I'm the one with the marketing background, thanks.
Oh, yeah, so I need to shut up,
No, I didn't say that. So people know whose resume is which, that's all.
That's right. Okay. That's the marketing guys, Phil.
Well, here's a twist that I didn't mention as we were talking about the show before we started. Now I'll throw it out here just to make everything more interesting. One of the things I want to do with all these various topics we're talking about tonight's kind of a grab bag show. We do these once in a while. It's just a lot of fun, interesting topics about the future. Every one of these that we bring up, we'll see how it would or could be used as a topic in our book that we're working on. And I'll go ahead and give our book update. We're working on the world's longest book. It's entitled The World Transformed. Naturally, it's going to be an e-book with an indefinite number of authors and an indefinite number of chapters. We're shooting for 1 million. I think 1 million sounds good. And so it'll be hopefully the longest book ever written. But leading up to that, we're going to do an abridged edition of The World Transformed, of the world's longest book. And we have been tracking over the last few weeks the authors as we're rounding them up. And Stephen, I'm pleased to tell you that of the 99 authors that we're looking to line up for The World Transformed, we are at 69 as of this evening.
That's great. I mean, I halfway expect, Phil, that within the next couple of weeks, this thing we'll have the original founding 99 authors. That'd be great.
Well, you know what's going to be potentially challenging? We'll see how it plays out, because I've been sending invitations out consistently, and I now have about 150 invitations that I've sent, okay? And we've only had 5 no's so far. That means that potentially there are another 80 people who could come back and say yes, which means that some of the people who intend to come back and be part of it aren't going to be able to, because I've already, I'm like one of those counter agents at the airport when they've overbooked the flight, right? So if,
that,
if you're listening and you got the invitation and you want to be part of the abridged edition, you need to get those responses in. Let us know that you intend to do that. I should mention
it's,
that
the abridged edition, Phil, is just to kind of let people know. I think it's the abridged edition that will probably see the light of day as a paper book at some point. Obviously, you can't have a million chapter book as a paper book. Not, you know, it's just not doable.
Not
so,
in a practical way. Yeah.
Not in
you
a practical way.
You might do it as a stunt,
yeah.
But yeah, you're not going. I mean, because our plan via the World Transformed Institute, our nonprofit affiliate organization, is to provide 10,000 copies of the abridged edition out into the world in general, and in particular to high school and college students, to get them interested in writing that all important 100th chapter of the World Transformed, and we're hoping to get up to a million candidates for the 100th chapter of the abridged edition. But you're absolutely right. This is a book that people will be able to hold in their hand. They'll be able to download to their Kindles, or their iPads. I guess supposedly, depending on how much memory you have on your device, you could download the ebook edition of the full book onto your device. But it would, depending on how big it gets,
it'd be the only thing
really
that the device would have on it. Probably, it'd be
that's
that one
right.
thing.
That would be pretty cool, actually. Dedicated to Kindles, yeah. Just with the World Transformed. I'm kind of liking that idea. Oh, I think we got a new promotion. So let me tell you who we've got. These are the 69 that we have signed up, and I should mention that there are actually 77 spots spoken for because we've got invitations out to some people who've never been on the program that we're having a little harder time getting in touch with. So we're giving them a little extra time to respond. So we're keeping their slots open. So in fact, there's only about 22 to go in terms of committed slots, but. You know, I'll be happy when I've actually got all 99 chapters in hand. That's when I'm going to be happy. Actually, when the book's been published. Well, I'll be pretty happy when we get 99.
Just stay happy. You know, start happy
yeah,
right
actually,
now.
Yeah, you know what?
Happy.
I'm ecstatic right now, come to think of it. I couldn't be happier just talking about this. So here's the list. Phil Bauermaster, Stephen Gordon, Ray Kurzweil, Ramez Nam, Brian Wong, PJ Manny, Michael Darling, John Smart, Jay Storrs Hall, Aubrey de Grey, George Dvorsky, James Hughes, Sonia Arison, Tobias Buckel, Jim Elvidge, Paul Vasquez, Natasha Vita Moore, Nikola Danilov, Alvis Bridges, David Brin, Reichert von Wolfshield, Aurelian Carpathia, Are You Serious, Dave Goebel, Maria Konovalenko, Ayesha Khanna, Paul Fernout, Joseph Rampola, Ben Gertzel, David Pierce, Joseph Jackson, Philip Van Nederveld, Terry Grossman, Martin Ford, Simone Syed, John Cabrera, Tyler Emerson, Max Marty, Barry Ptolemy, Jing Sui, Wayne Rudinsky, Ivan Kurgan, Sean Phillips, Jeff Hilford, Alex Lightman, Julio Prisco, Erica Lives, Will Brown, Jetnet Asifa, Yiking Liang, Cosmo Harrigan, Tudor Bologna, Glenn Reynolds, Christy Johnson, Romana Makado, Kanea Sunsu, Teresa Gonsi, Karen Marie, Gina Nano Girl Miller, to distinguish her from any other Gina Millers, we might get signed up. Federico Pistono, James Bennett, Arjun Kamfui, Extropia Da Silva, Christine Gaspar, Fiorelli Terenzi, Tracy Savage, Timothy Noonan, Radha Nilia, and Arnold Kling. That gives you 69 authors. What do you think of that list, Stephen?
It's a who's who of people who think about these topics and write about these topics. It's awesome. It's a great list of people. Can't wait to read the book, much less participate in the writing of it. It's an exciting project.
If we just hadn't had this idea and then thought of it and sat down and brainstormed who we'd like to have contribute to something like this, it would be this list, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
it's,
it would.
A lot of these people have been on this show and the predecessor show. Fast Forward Radio, we know these people. We've had great discussions with these people. We've read their books. A lot of them have books, and those who haven't had books have written extensively in other forms. And just a smart group of folks. I'm excited about this.
It's gonna be fantastic. And if we didn't have so much else to talk about, we could talk about the world's longest
just
book
that.
All night. But you know what? We've got a lost planet to account for here. Okay, so let's jump into our topics of the evening. Like I said, it's kind of a grab bag show, but this story really got my attention. I'll go ahead and put the link over in the chat room. This is an interesting astronomical discovery from last week. And, whoops, oh, it's got a weird thing going on here. There we go. I'm just sharing the link in the chat room there for those of you listening live. There's the story. And it's the story of an exotic young planet, as it reads here, that is not orbiting a star. This free-floating planet, the big long string of a name, is just 80 light-years away from Earth and has a mass only 6 times that of Jupiter. The planet formed a mere 12 million years ago, a newborn in planet lifetimes. So this is really interesting because I think we've talked about this subject before, the idea of free-floating planets, and I've also linked, I've got a link to another story here that was on Wired a couple of years ago that talks about how prevalent these things might be. But as far as I know, this is the first time that we've actually sighted one of these. In the past, they were determined to be in existence through gravity microlensing. Using microlensing, astronomers were able to say, look, there is a planet definitely there, but it's not close enough to any star to conceivably be in orbit around it. Therefore, we think that one must be floating free. But this one, we've actually aimed a telescope at, and to a certain extent, we can actually see that planet out there. And it's a very intriguing body. First, because it's relatively close to us, only 80 light years away. I say that as though that were close, and in galactic terms, that's pretty close. And a very young planet. So where'd this young planet come from? What's going on with this planet? A little bit bigger than Jupiter. What do you make of this, Stephen?
Well, I think that what's happening here is the same process that gives birth to stars on a smaller scale. If there's enough stuff floating around and it coalesces, then you'll have nuclear ignition and a star. If it's not quite enough, you get something like a brown dwarf or something that's even smaller, like this very large planet, but it's not quite a star. And it probably has satellites orbiting around it, but it's not burning, and so it's not, you know, so what you've got is a solar system in miniature with no bright center to it. It's fascinating. It's interesting.
It really is. The story in Wired that I just put the link up there on, they're talking about these cold, lonely exoplanets. The research they did using gravity microlensing, they actually determined, this is an estimate, of course, we can't see them all, we don't know this for sure, but the estimate is that there are approximately 1.8 times as many unbound, roughly Jupiter-sized objects as there are main sequence stars in our galaxy. Now, main sequence stars meaning not, I guess, counting brown dwarfs, which there might be more of them than there are main sequence stars as well. It's just interesting that we look at the night sky and we see all these stars, and to think that they're actually the minority of objects out there. Not only in
they're
terms of
the
each one of them
burning
probably
bright enough
planet.
For us to see. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, exactly. There's a lot of stuff out there. It's like, you know, the Star Trek reboot from 2009, the closing credits of that, where they were playing the Star Trek theme, and as they're showing the credits, they keep going from one big planetary system to another big planetary system to another one. And I was watching that, I was going, you know, this is kind of cool. It's making me a little bit dizzy, but it's just crazy because it's just implying that, like, the galaxy is just this chock full of planets place. And actually, I guess it sort of is, really. The thing is, there's just a lot of
just
a
incredible
lot of
amount of cold, dark space in between, though.
There is, yeah. I mean, they're not really crowded up like that, but there are a lot of planets out there. And the interesting thing about once you get to Jupiter size, although you don't have a fusion reaction going on, as you pointed out, it's not big enough to make a star. That is big enough for the gravity and whatever chemical stuff is going on there to generate a good deal of heat. So with 1.8 times as many of these things as you have stars, the chances that there is some life out in the galaxy increases exponentially, not only on these bodies, but on the bodies that are orbiting them. The universe becomes a more and more interesting place the more we learn about it. It seems every time we think we've got a pretty good picture of it, and it's kind of stark, and you know, vast distances, and there's not much out there. It just seems like there's more and more stuff out there, and more interesting things going on than we ever imagined. It really makes me want to get out there and do something. I have one more related story, and it just kind of jarred my memory as I was thinking about this. This was from a couple years ago also, and I'll share the link on this one too. Two astrophysicists believe that soon-to-be-published data will help prove the existence of a massive gas giant beyond Pluto's orbit. I think we talked about this just maybe a few months ago.
It starts with a T. What's the name of that planet? The proposed name is like Tyche or something like that?
Tyche, exactly. Yeah, they call it Tyche.
Oh, okay.
And we know it's there, if it is there, by the effect it has had on comets' orbits. That these guys couldn't account for what's making comets behave the way they do. And somebody said, you know, what if there was a large body out there, like a big planet out there? And they ran the numbers, and then it was like, boom, that explained it. Now we understand why there's these erratic comet orbits. Additional data being gathered. The problem is it's in the Oort cloud, and we can't see it if it's there. So we have to keep looking for clues for this planet, and we don't know for sure that it exists, but it would be another pretty solid data point to the idea that the galaxy is just chock full of big planets. If we have another one in our solar system that we didn't even know was there.
This proposed gas giant is like four times the size of Jupiter, something like that. It's
right.
Huge, right?
Right.
Yeah. My thought is this, it's supposed to be an Oort cloud. You've got something that massive orbiting the sun. At what point is something so big and so far away from the sun that it just breaks away from the solar system and goes wandering like these lonely planets that we've just heard about? I mean, how is the sun going to keep something like that in check as part of the system rather than it breaking away, that it being that big and having that much mass itself and that far out?
That's a really good question, because you have to wonder, gravity is still a very powerful force. If there's nothing else, if the sun is, say, I have no idea, half a light year away from this big planet, it's still the most massive.
Actually, according to the art, it said a full light year from us. So
okay, so it's a light year away.
A light year away from the sun. Yeah.
Well, so that's a long, long way away. But that still means the sun is exerting more gravity on this thing than anything else, because a light year from here, the closest thing to you is the sun, right? So it's a real interesting astrophysics question as to what happens that makes a planet stray, right? Does it bump into something else? Does something else come along and kind of tug it out off course, but doesn't capture it, just lets it float free in the galaxy? It's a really intriguing picture, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But these guys, these guys that have proposed it know more about this stuff than I do. So I'll leave it in their expert hands. And I would, it's one of those things that if it's true or false, I would guess that we would know one way or another pretty soon. I would say in the next 5 to 10 years, and not because necessarily we can we will be able to see it, but there'll be some way that we can detect it. That these guys come up with, because our ability to look out in the universe is just getting better and better all the time.
Let me tell you one reason why I hope it's there, and it's no big deal if it's not, but one reason I hope it's there is the moon was such a great target for getting us out into space. Boy, if that thing is there, that's a great target for getting us out into interstellar space, isn't it? It's like technically not interstellar.
Well, it would be kind of a last chance gas and bathroom before heading off to Alpha Centauri or something, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, it is the last rest stop for three light years, depending on what it's closest to. So
where it is,
it'll be interesting to track that one. Okay, we got a lot to cover. So what you got, Stephen? What's next?
Well, I've got this grab bag, and so the first thing I've got here is 5 innovation rules that you won't learn from Tony Stark. And it was in Forbes, and I thought it was fascinating. Let me boil it down real quick, because we have so much to cover tonight. Basically, it's this. Tony Stark is this lone genius, goes into his lab, cooks up something that no one else is privy to, and brings it out, and it saves the world kind of thing. That's kind of his
right
way of operating. And Forbes is saying that's cool and it's fun to watch, but in the real world, innovation is a collaborative thing. It does innovation doesn't go to the biggest genius. It goes to those who are most efficient at collaboration, and it's teams of people that would deliver us an Iron Man, not a lone Tony Stark in a cave. As much as we love that show, so I thought it was a great article. Let me put this in the chat room.
Yeah, do that. That's a good distinction between the fictional Tony Stark and the real men who sold the moon we talked about a few weeks ago, the real-life tycoons who are making Tony Stark-type things happen. They're geniuses. They've got tremendous visions, but they all have huge teams working for them actually making these things happen, whereas Tony does it all in his lab with his with Jarvis, right? That's all he needs. Real life, slightly different.
Yep. Okay, well, let's move on to the next one. We've got so much to cover.
Okay, well, I want to talk a little bit about amazing microbes. So I've got another link I'm going to. Oh, you know what we forgot to do is we forgot to say how any of these would relate to our book. Oops. That the first story, someone could propose putting a space station on Tyche. So that's how that could potentially relate to the book. How about yours?
Okay, mine. I would just basically point out that. You know, being part of a team and working well with others is social networks are a big part of the future. You know, and lone geniuses are they just don't deliver the way a good team does. Now, a good team probably has some geniuses on board, but they're not working alone. If you're smart enough, you know you need other people. That's just
absolutely
the name
and
of that.
And the book is itself a huge collaborative effort.
Huge collaboration. So
one of us.
We can't write the world's biggest book all alone. You know, so
wouldn't work. Well, we'd probably ramble a little. That's the bottom line.
Exactly.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about. I've just put the link in the chat room. This is really cool. It was over on IWET. It was a short little video talking about the seven wonders of the microbe world, and just a quick. Run through of how we got to where we are with using microbes to do all kinds of really cool things. And it talks about how they can be genetically engineered to produce insulin. That was one of the first ever biotech applications that were ever done. And since then, we're seeing microbes being used for a potential malaria treatment. We're seeing bacteria in yeast being used to break down waste products and produce ethanol and butanol, where microbes might actually be the key to providing fuel. Talking about interesting ideas about microbes being infused into clothing and making clothes that can self-clean or naturally glow in the dark. Now, these are all great ideas, and they're all things that either have already happened or are someone's in the process of making these things happen. So each one of these mentioned in this video is cool for that reason. Then I've got this other piece, which is called it was over on Next Nature, and it's called Microbial Factories, and it talks about a little bit more far-reaching of a set of applications for microbes. And once you start reading this stuff, we get a little bit into the wow, mind-blown kind of territory. It starts out talking about a parasite that makes rats fearless against cats. This is one of these really interesting parasite stories, and I can't think of the guy's name, but there's a TED Talk where...
Zombie rats.
Exactly, zombie rats, yeah. Where he talks about these parasites that get into a host and make it kill itself so that it can go back into the food chain and complete its life cycle. You know, these parasites that have these bizarre ways of continuing their life cycle. And this is one of the best ones ever, right? So it's this Toxoplasma gondii, it says in the article, is shed in cat feces, which get eaten by rats. Infected rats become fearless to cats and then get caught easily, thus completing the parasite cycle through its different hosts, because the cat kills the rat, eats it. Has a bowel movement, and boom, there, you know, the whole thing starts, the rat eats it, and the circle of life, you know, right out of the Lion King. But the question is, if a Parasite can make you feel friendly. What other unusual benefits might they have? And if you read the article that I've linked, and I'll put all these links up on worldtransform.com, they talk about how similar parasites might be used to help people break down social inhibitions to do a lot of the kinds of things that we've talked about around human augmentation, where it comes to managing our emotional life or managing our ability to interact socially. And we think of these as being drugs, or we think of them as being maybe like electrical components stimulating our brains or something like that. But there might be some pretty straightforward things that could be done with existing parasites, with slightly rewired, where people will be deliberately infecting themselves with parasites in order to gain certain benefits. You might even find one that makes you, believe it or not, more intelligent. So that one kind of got my attention. I won't talk about all of them. I'll just list off these topics. I'm sorry, Stephen. Did you say something?
I was just going to say, as long as it's myself that's making the choice and not, someone else deciding that, could be, there's Stephen 2.0 is needed. We need to do this to him.
This is the big danger. When Ramez was on a couple of weeks ago talking about the Nexus technology in his book, the potential for mind control, right? Yeah, what happens if you find a parasite that makes people really compliant and willing to do whatever you want to tell them? Yeah, just spread that out into the general population, and you've got your sheeple who will do whatever. And there are people who think that the government does stuff like that, right? There are people who think that that's why the government puts fluoride in water and things like that. But here is the actual technology by which it potentially could be done. Although, hopefully, we're talking about not a nightmare scenario, but an interesting new way for people to get things done. Other topics that are in this article: grow your clothing with microorganisms, building grows its own energy from an algae farming facade, toss the burrito, bacteria can filter antibiotics from water. This is really interesting. Antibiotics are a good thing when you're sick and you take them to make you well, but they're also in our water, and we don't want them there. They go after our gut bacteria and things like that. And so this is like we're on both sides of the war between bacteria and antibiotics, right? We use them to kill bacteria to make us well, and now we can also now use bacteria to kill antibiotics to keep antibiotics from making us sick. I think we're playing both sides there. It's kind of like Saudi Arabia in the Cold War, right? It's an interesting dynamic that we've got going on there. Then you've got a story called Next Nature Saves Old Nature, talking about how a modified tree frog might actually help fight off a fungus that is threatening a whole rainforest. And another headline, implanted into bacteria, synthetic DNA functions as a diagnostic computer. Well, these are just all awesome. I'm not going to go into details on all of them. I'm just going to recommend that people give some thought to the incredible applications potentially for microbes. Actually, there is one I'm going to talk about, which is using bacteria as a future 3D printer. Check this out. It says, what if 3D objects could not only be printed by normal techniques, but naturally grown using photosensitive bacteria? Fast Company reports that IDEO and University of California, San Francisco have been working on exploring the possibilities of exploiting known properties of microorganisms to literally grow the products we use every day. The idea is to use E. coli bacteria that reacts to light so they can be controlled to grow in a specific pattern, thereby growing consumer products. And then the next piece after that talks about nanotech diatoms. These are these single-celled algae that can synthesize nanoscale structures, these little complex silica shells. And I'm telling you, Stephen, between those two things, you've almost got the complete bacterial path to true molecular nanotechnology. That's right.
We've often said that life is the it shows that that sort of thing is nanotech is possible, isn't it? It's the proof of concept. But it may be more than the proof of concept. It may be,
we may end up having
to
be the driver. We talked about Drexler's book, Radical Abundance, talking about atomically precise manufacturing. By golly, that's what these microbes are doing. They're performing atomically precise manufacturing.
Ken says green goo. Yeah, it's the green goo as opposed to the gray goo. Green goo is the biological equivalent of nanobots.
Absolutely, that's the scary side for sure. Yeah. So if it doesn't go green goo or mind control, it could be pretty cool. I guess that's my
But, yeah, we want the friendly side of these technologies for sure.
Absolutely. Any of these ideas would have been good candidates for the kinds of things we'll be talking about in the book, The World Transformed. And anybody wants to riff on any of these kinds of ideas, they would all new applications for any of these ideas would also be fantastic.
Well, you know, let me throw out one thing that I may have mentioned. Seems like a while back when we were talking about these things. You know, when you have to spray crops, for example,
right.
You know, the pests eventually adapt to the what you're spraying, and you have to come out with something stronger or whatever, and it's just not it's not very environmentally friendly. If
right.
you were able to, put out some sort of living organism that preys on the parasite in some way, you know, if the parasite changes, the thing that's preying on the parasite changes right with it. Especially if
right.
we're talking microorganisms, it's the evolution of your solution is built in to the evolution of the pest that you're trying to control. So, you know, it's a better and more robust solution to some of these problems. So, yeah, I'm interesting.
Although I
got to
say that if anybody does a green goo horror movie, disaster movie, that what you just said is like the first scene. Am I not right? You know.
Oh yeah, you're gonna have some egghead come out and explain why we can't do anything about it. It adapts. It finds
it
life
adapts.
Finds a way.
We thought we killed the pest, but we're killing all humanity. And then Will Smith and his dog, and it's gonna be awesome.
Yeah,
okay,
you know.
So
Will Smith punches him, and that's it. Okay.
Takes care of the whole problem. All right, or Brad Pitt, whoever.
That's what I call
whoever's taking
guy.
It on these days. Okay, what do you got, Steven?
Okay, next thing is the ethics of autonomous cars. I found this fascinating. It's think of it this way. You know, when normally, you know, the ethics are very straightforward, right? I mean, if you build an autonomous car, the ethics are that, you know, it's supposed to get you safely to where it is that you're going, right?
Right.
And so they said, but, you know, there are times that a driver is presented with situations where they have to break the law to be safe. You know, if for example, there's a log that's fallen across the road, a human driver will stray over into the oncoming lane to avoid the log in the road, even though it's a no passing zone. You know,
right?
But they see nobody's coming, so hey, I'm going to stray over here just to get around this log and be safe. And you know, there's other times where you might need to get on the gas and actually break the speed limit to get out of the way of something. You know, just you know, there are a number of situations where, you know, now do you when you're programming this autonomous car, are you going to allow for that kind of thing, and how much are you going to allow for that kind of thing? And what if you had a situation where, you know, you had a crowd of people that are in the middle of the road? Do you keep on the road, or, you know, if it's a situation where it's a sudden thing where you got to choose between the crowd of people on the road or the two or three kids on the sidewalk? You
right.
know, I mean, it's a horrible decision for any human driver to have to make, and you know, but and so you can't really blame a human driver for what happens after that because it's a split second sort of thing, you know.
Right.
But
whatever
happens
when a driverless car does it,
when a driverless car does
it,
it's got to be the programmer has time to think about it. What
right.
what do I do if I'm presented with a situation where it's a couple of people over here on the sidewalk versus five people that are crossing that just darted out in front of me? What do I do? You know, that's some tough ethics involved there, and I found it to be a fascinating article, and so you know it's going to be interesting. Yeah.
Now,
you know,
is this
it
where
goes beyond,
finally
it's
we'll
sort
see
of the
something
three
like Asimov's Three Laws of Robotics?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. It'll turn out they won't be laws that are, just built into robots. They'll be laws that guide people who are programming robots.
The most interesting ethical quandary I thought was, what about the difference between a public car, that would be like a, it could be a taxi that's a public kind of service versus a car that you own. Would the car that you own, would it be proper for it to, you know, to do everything in the world to save you versus a situation where, you know, a public vehicle might be well expected to sacrifice itself and maybe its passenger in favor of the five people over on the sidewalk or something. Do you write the ethics programs differently for public versus private cars? There's going to be a lot of discussions about this. This is going to be an area that'll be talked about and discussed a lot.
You know, maybe there's going to be jobs for lawyers after all in this driverless car world.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
Maybe I need to make myself an expert in this field. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're off to a great start. I would stay on it. It's true. The technology to move people around turns out that's the easy problem to solve, isn't it? I mean, not that there's anything easy about it, but it's the part that. That they're making it happen, and as we've talked about, that's the thing where just through, call it Moore's Law, call it the law of accelerating returns, just through technological progress, sooner or later, cars are going to be better at doing this than we are. And we've described that as kind of a singularity where we'll say, well, then we have to let cars do it, because outside of all those sticky situations, just in the normal day-to-day situations, a lot of people's lives will be saved. People won't be dying in the... because somebody's texting, or because somebody got mad, or any of those silly reasons. But what happens with these cases where there's no easy good answer?
That's right. And here's the thing. I don't think it's going to be very hard to. It's a hard, difficult problem. I shouldn't say that, but we are not that great at driving. We people are. We're just barely capable of doing it. We still cause 40,000 highway deaths a year in this country, which is somewhat equivalent to the loss of our soldiers in 14 years in Vietnam. Okay,
right.
So the numbers are close. We do a Vietnam every year on the highway in this country because we're just not that great at it. It's just people
and
are not.
And most of those 99.9% of those are not huge ethical dilemmas, right? There's somebody did something stupid. Right.
Yeah.
I
would say probably 80% of those are involve alcohol and drugs in some way.
Right.
Nowadays it's texting is the other thing. I think it'll be coming up with a car that can do it better than we can. I think that's just right around the corner. These ethical dilemmas will be with us a while, a lot longer than we'll be solving these problems. A lot longer from now than the arrival of the autonomous car. These things are going to have to take some time to shake out.
And you know what? It'll be interesting. Here's a prediction. I don't make many. Here's a prediction. There will be a movement to eliminate autonomous cars because of a few ethical sticky situations, even though tens of thousands of lives will be saved every year.
Yeah, some powerful person's child will die in some horrible way involving an ethical dilemma that a car could not solve. And I'm not trying to make light of that kind of situation at all. But that's the sort of thing, tragedies create horrible law. And I can see exactly what you're talking about, and I completely agree with your prediction.
These are very rare situations, and driverless cars will make them even rarer. That's our point, right?
Ken, you're right. You're right. I'm not seeing this as a downside of autonomous cars. I'm just saying ethical dilemmas will be with us even after the arrival of the autonomous car. So,
that's
all right.
Right. That's
what's
right.
The next
life,
one, Bill?
Life's going to be a lot better, and and we'll still have problems.
We'll still have problems. Life will be better, and we'll still have problems.
All right, let's talk about these students who 3D printed a rocket engine, and I've just pasted that link into the chat room. Great video of this little rocket engine working. And how did they make it? Well, they used a 3D printer. University students, they just a couple weeks, not even 2 weeks ago, in the Mojave Desert, proved that their rocket engine that they made with a 3D printer could work. This is pretty cool. It's a small rocket. It's just 7 inches long, and it's designed to be the third stage in a CubeSat launcher. These CubeSats are these miniature satellites that usually don't weigh much more than 3 pounds. So this is the smallest rocket in the whole assembly, and it's the least powerful one. It's the once you're way up there and once you're going really fast, the rocket that takes care of that part of the load. Fueled by kerosene and liquid oxygen, it can provide up to 200 pounds of thrust, which is a good deal of thrust for a 3 pound satellite. And it comes to $6,800 to make this thing. Now, you put all the other pieces aside. You know, you say, well, it's not a very big rocket engine, you know, and it's just some little kerosene thing. It only provides 200 pounds of thrust. That last number should really get your attention, okay? Because I'm telling you right now, I haven't priced rocket engines, but I'm going to say that $6,800 is the bargain basement price for any rocket that you can buy anywhere. That would be part of an actual satellite assembly, and the fact satellite launch assembly, and the fact that you can print one of these out on a 3D printer. Of course, that technology is coming along and coming along and coming along, even as we speak. And the fact that they say, well, their next plan is to do the first stage rocket. They're not even going to do the middle one. They're doing the first stage rocket next. This all starts to add up to wow. The production of rocket engines, the production of space infrastructure, maybe is about to become a lot cheaper than we ever imagined it was going to be. I mean, this isn't even something that I've heard anyone talk about. Hey, what happens when you can just mass produce rocket engines, right? Whoever even thought about that as a possibility? But here we got college students printing out a workable rocket engine. That could actually be used as part of an assembly to get a satellite into space, and moving on to that next step. I would think that people who are interested in things like developing, you know, the private development of space, the mining of asteroids, any of that kind of stuff, getting people into space, going to Mars, any of those kinds of wild, grand projects that we've talked about over the last few months are going to be very interested in this development, don't you think?
Absolutely. Yeah. Can you imagine, Phil, a situation like an Apollo 13, problem, and how awesome it would have been to have had a 3D printer that could print out, a rocket engine for one thing,
right.
Or the air filter that they needed at one point. To me, it's it's going to be an important part of survival in space is the ability to produce whatever it is you need to produce when you need it, because you may not know before you need it that the need will be there, because, you know, who knows? And so, 3D printing is going to be huge for space, and not just getting us there, but also managing to survive there. It's going to be huge. So.
Well, one of the things we were talking about a while back when we were talking about planetary resources was this idea that the old NASA model is every component you make, it's best of breed, it's made by the highest bidder, money is no object, right? You can't spend it. So you get one of them, and it costs $1.8 million, right? And the planetary resources model is going to be...
And its failure rate is like one in a jillion, you know?
Yeah, one in a jillion, fail. Yeah. And then it goes to Mars and fails, right? It's embarrassing.
Yeah.
But the planetary resources model is we'll make 100 of them, and they've got a failure rate of, 20% or
50%.
Some horrible sounding.
You can have a failure rate.
Like that's okay.
If you have 100 of them and have a failure rate of 50%, you got 50 probes on Mars. You know, I mean, that's
exactly.
Yeah, that's and I really agree with the new model. That's the way to go. Is cheap and disposable. This idea that you have to have these huge, very very expensive probes that are in clean rooms and everything versus the I've got 10 probes on my desk. You have to move that probe out of the way while I pour the coffee. It's a different way of looking at it, and I think it's a more robust way of doing things. If you have a failure, it's not going to It's not going to be a mission-ending thing if you've got many backups. So
absolutely. Another
yeah.
Great. Ken's on a roll tonight. In the chat room, he says robots will beat us to Mars. Ken,
they
did
already
in
have,
1977.
Ken. Yeah. They beat us. They were there in 77 and have been there ever since.
That's
yeah.
Right. okay. What's next, Stephen?
Okay. This is not so much of a future thing, but I found it fascinating, and I don't know that we've ever talked about it. National Radio Quiet Zone. Have you ever heard of this, Phil?
No, but that sounds like something that would be of interest to the fluoride in the water crowd, right?
Yeah, it might be. It might be.
Yeah.
It is for a radio telescope in West Virginia. It's 13,000 square miles of no radio signals at all, okay? I mean, they don't have radio towers. They don't have cell phones. If you live in this 13,000 square mile area, it shows a picture of this town with, you know, they got phone booths everywhere. You know, it's the last place they have public phones. You know, they have one radio station that broadcasts on a low enough frequency that it's allowed, and everything else is just not allowed. You know, if you can't have a Wi-Fi network set up in this zone, apparently. They're really strict about it because, you know, they've got this radio telescope that's the largest movable dish radio telescope in the world, apparently. And it needs radio quiet in order to be able to see out into the universe. And I highly recommend the article as an interesting look at how people live, even in our world, in a way that's like, you know, 20, 30 years ago. You know, nobody has cell phones. What's the point? You know, this is an NPR story, and they kind of romanticized it a little bit. I would think, Phil, that it would suck. I'm just going to say, I would not want to live without, being told I couldn't have Wi-Fi and a cell phone and all that. It would be a bizarre step into the past that I would not want to take. At any rate,
it's
an interesting story.
It is just a little bit not as bad as if it were an electricity-free zone or a running water-free zone or something like that, right? It's hard to imagine trying to live like that. I mean, really. You know, that's a daunting thought. And how big is this zone?
13,000 square miles of West Virginia.
Jeez.
It includes the town of Harrisburg. Yeah, it's huge. It's a...
radio stations? I mean, they can't be right.
No radio stations or anything. There's like one, it's like it's like a bluegrass station, you know, I mean, that's allowed because it broadcasts on a low frequency that's able to, they're able to have it there. So, anyway, that's it. And so it's I get the feeling it's a pretty primitive way of living. And the folks that live there, you know, it may not bother them much because that's the way they've always lived. But it's, I couldn't imagine. And, you know, Charlottesville, West Virginia, is right on the edge of this. So, and then Harrisburg is right in the middle of it. It's the only town of any size that I see in this map here. Harrisonburg, excuse me, West Virginia. But it's,
Somebody's going to launch a big First Amendment case against this at some point. You know, I mean, it just...
They'll say, "Well, you can speak your mind if you want to. You have to drive into Winchester, West Virginia,
<That's right.
laughs> to get on the radio and speak your mind
from saying what you want to say.
You can even be on the internet,
but you have to use.
Yeah, you can be on the internet. You just have to have a cable modem, you know. So, but it's
exactly
a different way of living.
Wacky. Okay. Well."
So
a good idea in the book would be for somebody to figure out how you can have a big radio telescope without having that problem, right?
I know. Let's put one in outer space. Let's have a Hubble radio telescope this time. Do a radio telescope like a Hubble. I think that's the way.
Well,
to
very
go.
Quickly, let's talk about our breakthrough in fusion. This was a big story a week ago, and it looks like. You know, we try not to get too excited when we hear something like this because it's always possible that we're misinterpreting the data or that, that this isn't as big a deal as they're saying. But it looks like nuclear fusion has worked. For nuclear fusion to be feasible, what needs to happen is you need to get a nuclear reaction, a thermonuclear reaction, excuse me, that produces more energy than it took to cause the reaction. I mean, that's just generally how you produce energy, right? You get something going that puts out more energy than you put in. Up to this point, every fusion reaction that we've ever had, outside of like a thermonuclear bomb, but any attempt to have controlled nuclear fusion has not worked in that sense. It's like we can make fusion occur, but we have to dump so much energy into it that we don't get that much back out. We don't get as much out as we put in. Well, that has changed as of a couple of weeks ago, and that is pretty exciting. Actually, it happened. Right at the end of September, it was a quick ignition, and they had to really blast into this core with lasers in order to make it happen. But it's a first step, and it's a pretty exciting.
Well, they got more back out than the energy it took to blast it. Right? I mean, that's right. That was the key measure, is that they got more energy out than they had to put in, and so. You know, that's, to me, that's very, very exciting. It's the first time they've ever been able to use to see that in fusion at all in any kind of reactor. Am I right, Phil? First time. So, yeah, it'll be a while probably before they're able to scale that up. But that's encouraging. It shows that it's what's possible, and. Maybe that will. I mean, more money will be put into this research now that they have shown that. That'll encourage those that are holding the purse strings.
The thing is, once you've shown that it's feasible, I mean, we've always known it's feasible because the sun exists, right? We've always known that you can have a nuclear, a thermonuclear reaction that produces more energy than gets put in. But now we've shown that we can do it on Earth. They can be done in a contained space, can be done in a plant. There's still a long way to go to say this could be an economically viable model, a long way to go to even to say that this is something we can do routinely and that there's good reason to pursue it. But for those who have suspected all along that there is good reason to pursue it and that potentially there could be an economically viable model, this is a very, very optimistic, very positive step, a huge first step. In that direction, and it'll be interesting to see. I mean, we've talked about, you know, is fusion ever going to show up? It's been 50 years away for the last 50 years, and will it always be 50 years away? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe now we're actually closing in on it. We shall see.
I read a scientist, and it may have been something that was linked to by Brian Wong. So much of my knowledge of this comes from his blog, Phil, but. The scientist likened it to a mechanic trying to build the world's first automobile with no prior knowledge of automobiles, but blind, because you can't see what you're doing at a small level, so you can't see exactly what you're doing. So imagine being blind and trying to build the world's first car. You know, with that level of complexity,
right.
That's what you're talking about with that kind of with this kind of breakthrough. So no wonder it's been a tough nut to crack, but maybe they're getting closer, and that's exciting.
Absolutely.
You know, a gallon of seawater has enough nuclear fuel, and when I say nuclear, I'm talking about fusion type fuel.
Yep.
I hate to say, because it was something like, when I read it was something like a 1,000 gallons of gasoline worth of energy and a single gallon of seawater.
Right.
You know, it's something crazy like that. We just need to know how to do this. We just need to get good at this, and that's very encouraging.
All of our energy problems will be solved.
It will be solved. It'll be solved. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Very briefly, let me just do this. Let me do this last one, and then we'll have cleared out my list, which was
okay. Sure. Go ahead.
If you don't mind my going out of turn. The last story we have is about an ingenious 19-year-old. I'm sorry. My last story. If we have time, Stephen, you got one more. Develops plan to clean up oceans in 5 years. I would just cite this is exactly the kind of thing we're looking for in the book. Okay.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be this big, because you can transform the world in a very small way. You can come up with a very small idea that that has huge repercussions. But this is a big idea, and it sounds like an awfully good idea that this 19-year-old kid has come up with. He calls it the Ocean Array Plan. It's a system that would use the power of currents and use solar power to launch these very large platforms near places where there's a good deal of debris in the ocean, plastic debris, and it would collect all this. I won't go into all the details, but it sounds like a very workable model, and I imagine that eventually something very much like this will be put in place to address this really pressing problem that we hear so much about. And, you know, we always hear about it as, oh, no, the oceans are dying. It's getting worse. This is terrible. There's this sea of junk. There's this island of junk. This is the kind of news on this I like to hear, right? Well, hey, here's an idea how we could address it. And in fact, we could have the whole problem solved in 5 years. That's the kind of thinking that that really makes my day when I see something like that. And when it comes from somebody who's 19 years old and people are raising their eyebrows and going, you know what, this could possibly work, that's just a fantastic story.
We might want to pull out a chair for this 19-year-old in the book. We might want to reach out to him. That's an awesome idea.
Not a bad idea.
It reminds me of something I heard on Umano about a week or two ago about a group of ocean-going robots that work in concert to eat jellyfish in places that are overrun with jellyfish. They herd them, and then they literally chomp down on them. It had video and everything. That was so cool.
Wow.
And things that robots that work in concert with one another are going to be big. That's going to be a big thing. Okay.
Absolutely. What do you
okay,
got?
The next one I've got here, and I guess this one will be the last one tonight, is self-assembling robots will blow your mind. A group at MIT has been working with these little cubes that look about like an inch and a half. I'm guessing that's about how big they are, and they've got they've got magnets in them, and they've also got like these spinning actuators that they'll spin them, and then they stop them, and it makes the cubes jump and hop and move in ways, and they'll connect in each other, and they're working on ways to make the the ultimate goal is to be able to at a very high level say, okay, cubes, y'all assemble into a chair. And
right.
The cubes then decide individually how to do that. That's what they're working on. And the video, and let me go ahead and put this link in the chat room. The video it looks like something like it's like Tony Stark's suit jumping on him. You know,
Josh Hall, call your office. This sounds like
it's cool stuff
to me. Yeah.
Oh yeah, and it's of course we're talking inch and a half blocks now, but who knows? They can scale that down after they
get the intelligence where they can figure out how to assemble themselves into things, and then just miniaturize
it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
These little inch and a half blocks will be the supercomputers of the 1950s. You know, they get smarter and smaller over time.
Exactly.
So it's a very cool thing to see. So.
I love it. I love the idea. All right. Well, we're just about at the end of our time here, Stephen. So what's our music this evening?
Our music tonight is Awesome Anne by Monk Turner.
Awesome Anne by Monk and Turner. All right. Well, that sounds like the perfect conclusion. Hey, you know what? I'm seeing in the chat room we almost had a guest. We're going to have to work that out with you, buddy. Next time we'll make that happen. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thank you all for being with us, whether you're listening live or listening via MP3. Thanks for being part of The World Transformed. We'll be back again next week at the regular time. And don't forget, in 3 weeks, we've got Zoltan Isfahan coming on to talk about his novel, The Transhumanist Wager. So until next time, live to see it.